the sun. How does water find its way? What is the composition of man?
This dramatic video opens a new exhibit at Union Station about the life and work of one of the world's most renowned painters.
Leonardo da Vinci was much more than a painter. He was a skilled anatomist, an accomplished sculptor, a talented poet, a chef, a philosopher, and a master of ceremonies. He was the definition of a Renaissance man.
Leonardo da Vinci was the guy whose life experience gave rise to the whole idea of what it means to be a Renaissance man, which was fine and dandy during the Renaissance when you could apparently be an architect, engineer, and world-famous painter all at once. But what does it mean to be a Renaissance man or woman today? I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's the big question on KCUR's Central Standard. We've got a couple of modern-day Renaissance people in the studio this morning, and we'll hear from them shortly. But first, let's hear a little more about the original Renaissance man. Stephanie Story, you've written about Leonardo da Vinci in your book Oil and Marble, which will be published March 1st. What's the premise of that book?
It's historical fiction about the rivalry between Leonardo da Vinci and Michelangelo. Both of them lived in Florence from 1501 to 1505, and they hated each other. But during those years, that's when their rivalry drove Leonardo da Vinci to paint the Mona Lisa while Michelangelo was carving the David just down the street.
So what was the nature of their conflict?
You know, they were opposites in so many ways. Leonardo was 23 years older than Michelangelo. Leonardo was very charming, beloved by many, handsome. By the time the two met, Leonardo was already one of the most famous people on the peninsula. He was revered as an artist during his lifetime. Michelangelo, on the other hand, is a young up-and-coming sculptor. He's in his mid-20s. He's temperamental, socially awkward, and he is ugly. I mean, he's not an attractive guy. He had his nose broken by a jealous apprentice when he was a kid, and it never healed properly. So I think just from personality-wise, they didn't like each other. But then think about if you're Leonardo da Vinci and you are at the top of your career and you're in Florence and this young up-and-coming sculptor comes into your town and tries to infringe on your territory. He was a threat. And I think to Michelangelo, he wanted to impress Leonardo, and Leonardo just did not want to be impressed when they first met.
So you think that Leonardo da Vinci was sort of pushed to accomplish even more based on the appearance of this young upstart on the scene?
I do. I think that they drove each other. I think, you know, the aging Leonardo is around 50 years old at the time when Michelangelo makes his appearance. And he'd already painted the Last Supper up in Milan. He was already a well-regarded military engineer. But with Michelangelo showing up, he had to best him. Michelangelo is down the street carving what is now one of the most famous statues in the world. And when Michelangelo saw the progress on the David, he knew he had to come up with something special. And so that's why I believe he pushed himself to connect so deeply with Lisa Gherardini del Giocondo, who became Mona Lisa.
Talk to me about the nature of Leonardo da Vinci's varied accomplishments. I mean, he charted new territory in so many fields, art, science, philosophy. Was there a spirit or approach that unified his various endeavors?
I think his unifying approach was he wanted to be varied, if that makes sense. He wanted to be creative in all aspects. He felt like you couldn't be an artist unless you knew about nature, unless you studied anatomy, unless you studied biology. He did feel like it all fed into art, but his interests ranged so much. He felt that art fed music, fed science, fed math, fed anatomy, and it all comes back to art again. He was most famous as an artist, but he did sell himself multiple times as a military engineer.
Tell me about him as an engineer.
As an engineer, he's an interesting guy. He was so obsessed with primarily the movement of water and birds. That's a lot of what drives his energy in the world of engineering. Yes, he also creates bridges and tanks, but a lot of his interest comes from the sky and the sea. And I think that that's fascinating because that all comes from nature. That all comes from what we already have around us. And that was so important to Leonardo's thought processes, to Leonardo's art, to Leonardo's engineering in general. It all comes from the world around you. So his flying machines, I think that's why he made so many flying machines. He was genuinely obsessed with getting a human being up in the air.
Like a bird.
He was also, yes, like a bird. He really genuinely wanted to fly like a bird. He said if he ever got up there, he would never want to come back down to the earth ever again.
So is same, the Renaissance man, do you think that the model for that being someone who was fascinated by nature and that nature contains all of these things, right? Aesthetics, mechanics, all of it. Do you think that a fascination with nature is kind of an underpinning of the Renaissance man idea?
I think certainly for Leonardo it was. I think that was so much of what drove him as a human being. And I think that it shows up in other people who are Renaissance people, who have a wide variety of interest from art to science and these days computer sciences and tech. I think it all does grow from the world we see around us, the landscapes and the trees and the sky and the water.
Tell me about, tell me about Leonardo da Vinci as an architect.
Oh, as an architect, one of the things that I love about Leonardo da Vinci as an architect is he's about the only guy I know who goes out and sketches flowers to build buildings. You can see in his notebooks this juxtaposition between building drawings for architecture next to drawings of flower petals. And you can see the remnants of those pieces of nature in the buildings that he designed. And I just think that speaks to this whole idea of the Renaissance man, of this cross-pollinization between botany and architecture, or between optics and art.
Something that fascinates me as I listen to you is that so many processes were more time-consuming in the time period we're talking about. I mean, we didn't live in a highly industrialized world where creating a machine or a building took a short time. I mean, these things took a long time. And additionally, I mean, life expectancy was much shorter back then. Leonardo da Vinci accomplished all of these many careers in how many years?
He died in his 60s.
So not, I guess, a short life, but certainly not. He didn't get those couple extra decades someone might have today.
That's correct. And I started to say, I believe it was 67, but I didn't want to be completely wrong. But yes.
Learning about really accomplished people from previous eras, I do sometimes marvel at how much work they produced until I find out that they had often servants who took care of all of their worldly needs for them. And then I think, well, who knows what any of us could accomplish if the basic concerns of daily life were taken care of for us and just a non-issue. Did Leonardo have that kind of assistance to free him up for things like observing closely the behavior of water?
Of course he had. He had roomfuls and roomfuls of studio assistants, usually provided by his patrons. He also had a couple of assistants who followed him around for most of his life. So he had a couple of loyal people who took care of things like going to the market for the shopping and those kinds of things. But I also think that for Leonardo specifically, the time that it took to accomplish things, what you were talking about earlier, was invaluable to him. He liked to take time. He liked things that took him months and years to accomplish, because it did give him enough time to stop and think. Notoriously, he might think about a single brushstroke for several days before he applied a drop of paint to the wall. If you were living in this day and age, when you had to have something accomplished in 6 months, you might not have been able to accomplish the depth of innovation that he could.
And you'd have to have a real singularity of vision.
Yes, today you would. Possibly. I also think there's some room to be able to cross-pollinate today. But for Leonardo, that ability to study several different fields and take his time in them and not be rushed was, I think, key to his innovation.
What do you know about Leonardo da Vinci's upbringing and education, how those might have shaped him?
He was born illegitimately. His mother and his father were not married, which even though in the time period it didn't carry as much of a stigma as it did during other eras, certainly affected his life. He was not allowed to have a proper education. He was not allowed to study Latin. So later in his life, he tried to teach himself Latin by scribbling down Latin words over and over again, because he always felt like he wasn't living up to this ideal man because he didn't have that education. And so he was always striving for that. When he was young, since he couldn't become a notary like his father was, because he was illegitimate, his father put him in the studio of a famous bronze sculptor in Florence at the time named Andrea del Verrocchio. And so Leonardo studied in Andrea del Verrocchio's studio. And one of the things I love about that is in a bronze sculptor studio at the time, you would have to learn scaffolding. You would have to learn how to melt down bronze and cast it. There was a lot of engineering and mechanical practices in Andrea del Verrocchio's studio that I think Leonardo carried with him for the rest of his life. One of the things that he did when he was young in that studio was, you know, the famous Duomo in Florence. At the top of that Duomo, there's a bronze ball. Leonardo was part of the team that placed that bronze ball on the top of the Duomo with Andrea del Verrocchio when he was young. And I think having to learn to scale that Duomo, to put that ball on the top of that dome, was a major part of how he saw the world.
Can you explain that a little more?
Sure. The Duomo in Florence, it's a famous tall dome of the cathedral. At the very top of it, the city asked that there be a bronze decorative ball placed at the top. And so Andrea del Verrocchio's team, studio, had to figure out how to get to the top of that cathedral, how to place that ball. They had to build scaffolding. They had to climb it. And Leonardo was part of that team. And I love that he had to learn to build that kind of architectural scaffolding. I love that he was involved in teams that weren't just painting or weren't just designing. They were also having to solve mechanical architectural problems.
Today, we use the term Renaissance man kind of loosely. We might even confuse being a good multitasker for being a Renaissance man. What is the difference?
I think it's the level of obsession. You know, a multitasker just sort of does things on the surface, over here, and then you go over here, and you're doing two things at the same time. Leonardo da Vinci was outrageously obsessed with anatomy, with art, with optics, with hydrology, obsessed. He would spend hours studying a single flower or the way the water flowed. So I think it's the depth of the cross-genre obsession that he never stayed on the surface with anything. He was constantly trying to understand the full depth of an area. He didn't want to let it go until he had solved a big problem or had drilled all the way to the bottom of an area. And that's, I think, the difference. I don't think multitasking and doing six things while you're at your desk makes you a Renaissance man. I think it's being absolutely obsessed with different areas in the world, with finding things that you can't let go of, but they're maybe on opposite sides of the spectrum.
Is it possible to be a true Renaissance man or woman along the lines of someone like Leonardo da Vinci today?
You know, I actually think we may be ripe for that new kind of era. Leonardo was born at about the same time that the printing press was invented. And I think that the printing press gave him an ability to have access to more information. I think that's very akin to the advent of the internet. And when it came about and everybody got all of this huge swath of information, that now we're finally going to be able to build off of that, much like Leonardo did. So I think we're in a moment of technology where, yeah, we all have the potential to become a Renaissance man or woman.
When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll hear what a couple of Kansas Cityans, who come as close as we can find, have to say about that. I'm Gina Kaufman, and KCUR's Central Standard will be right back. Good morning. I'm Gina Kaufman, and you're listening to KCUR's Central Standard. Right now, Union Station has an exhibit all about the life and work of Leonardo da Vinci, the man whose career in everything from oil painting to engineering gave us the idea of the Renaissance man, someone who achieves excellence in many different arenas. Is that something we value and nurture today? Stephanie Story, author of a novel based on Leonardo da Vinci's life. What do you think? Do we nurture that?
I don't know if we necessarily nurture that today, because I think people are asked to be very specialized. But I think that the environment itself out in the world just gives us the potential to capitalize on all of that. And if society would start to nurture it and hold it to a higher standard and tell us all, yes, you need to be obsessed in multiple areas, I think then we would all have a better opportunity into becoming Renaissance men and women of today.
We're joined now by Bibi Cronwall. She's a neuroscientist, an educator, and a master gardener. Bibi, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you for having me.
I should acknowledge that you and I are family, although it's in such a roundabout way that on paper, people may not consider us relatives at all, but we've known each other and cared about each other for a long time, so I'm going ahead and claiming you, okay?
Okay, that's fine.
You're a neuroscientist, which I think of as a career that requires such an intense focus and specialization that it wouldn't necessarily leave a lot of room for outside interest, but you've always had a lot of interests outside the lab. Where did your passion for science and nature come from?
Let me first say, that was fabulous to hear about Leonardo. I have to read that book. I don't want to in any way compare myself with Leonardo, but his passion for nature is something that I have had since as far back in time I can remember. I was really, at the time, obsessed with naming things, just like other little kids. It started out with plants because they stood still, so I could compare them with the pictures in the book. That was actually the first book I ever bought. It was Swedish Flowers in Color. And then I bought the book, Bird Book. That was trickier because they flew around. But technology helped there. And it has continued. I think everything I have done and am doing stems from my interest in nature, both my professional life and what I'm doing now as a retired person.
Your professional life, you didn't get into neuroscience right off the bat, as I understand.
No, I was fiddling around with many thoughts about what I was going to become when I grew up. I haven't grown up yet, but I, at that time, a biology teacher sounded, very good. But I was, of course, also thinking of a physician or a chemical engineering. That was really very interesting. I also was thinking of becoming a journalist because I liked writing very much. And I actually had a standing little nature column in our local newspaper, and I started, inspired by a nationwide movement for field biology for young people. So I was very much involved with biology, have always been, and I hope always going to be.
How did you end up focusing on the brain?
Well, one of my thoughts was also to become a veterinarian. So I was fiddling around with that at university. My master's degree had to do with a skin disease in salmon. It was very important at the time because they started to rear salmon and they got this disease. However, it turned out that my institute, my department, wasn't ready for virology. And it was kind of slimy at the same time. The other specialty in the department was actually neurobiology. So I got into that.
You're also a master gardener. What does that mean?
It means that I have taken a semester long, if we talk in academic terms, of lectures at the University of Missouri Extension, and passed the tests, I gave a little presentation, and then I spent 45 hours as a volunteer the upcoming year, and then you continue to do 25 hours per year till you retire after 10 years.
So tell me about gardening in your life and how it fits together with your profession.
One could say it doesn't fit so well, but it's all has to do with observation of detail. I am, when it comes to gardening, I wouldn't use obsessed, but I like to study plants from a anatomical, physiological point of view, and the neuroscience that I did was all at the microscopical level, which is to study and identify structures and see how they work together. So it kind of hangs together if you try to make them hang together.
How did you get into gardening?
I've always been poking around with plants, but it wasn't actually until I moved to the States, especially since I came to Kansas City, that I have had a garden to garden. And also here, it's more difficult to get out in the field. So gardening is a natural thing here, I think.
Your husband, Stephen Morris, was also a neuroscientist and also, to my mind, a Renaissance man. He built cars, perfected the craft of, I believe it was 18th century walnut cabinetry. I might be wrong about that. Woodworking, shelf building.
Yeah, he was, I would say, more closer to the definition of a Renaissance man. He was a very skilled scientist, and he built his own machinery for the science that he was involved in. He loved tinkering with cars. He, as I always kidded, he can take them apart, put the parts on a tarp, shake it, and put the car together again. Although his friends now say, well, he had a specialty of putting old and new parts together and make them work in a way that we never understood. And that becomes clear now when I see what he's done to our home. It has some surprising quirks.
Yeah, he built things in general. And
yeah,
he also built a computer-like device in his spare time back in the day before computers were household items.
That was way, way, way back in time when we first met 40 years ago. But he was also a good musician, a really good musician, American folk music. But he also knew everything about other kinds of music. He wanted to become an architect. He constructed or designed several of the rooms in our home. I did the artistic part, the colors and the textiles and things like that, softer things.
Was there something about the way his mind worked or the way he viewed life that you think is crucial to the whole Renaissance person idea?
He was interested in everything.
And simple as that.
Yeah, and he wanted to figure out how things worked. Be that now how the nervous system works, the minutiae of that, how a car worked, how you could use a circular saw to how you played a certain instrument.
Do you think that the idea of the Renaissance man or woman is alive and well in 21st century America?
I was thinking about that when I listened to our author. And the internet has really, it may very well help us to do that. It has actually helped me in a way to continue, since you can't be a scientist without a lab and a group. And I closed my lab some time ago. And now I can actually focus on botany in a way that is new to me, or continued what I used to do with the help of the internet.
So do you think also that maybe different phases of life allow us to pursue different things, maybe more than pursuing them simultaneously?
Absolutely. Being a scientist, that's an around-the-clock job. Being a master gardener was my retirement project. I couldn't do it while I was working.
Does your knowledge of how the brain works give you any insight into how a person develops extraordinary creativity and problem-solving abilities in more than one field?
No.
It doesn't?
Not the knowledge that I have a deep understanding of. And as a matter of fact, our knowledge of the brain is changing, deepening by the day, and it's getting more and more complicated.
So it's too complicated to even sort that out.
For me, it is.
Let's talk to James in Kansas City.
Hi, thank you very much. I was listening to it, and of course, I really appreciate Leonardo da Vinci's work, Michelangelo also. I'm blue-collar, grew up single-parent family. Ended up being a single parent myself, and I got to thinking about it from a practical perspective. What I joke around and say about myself is that I'm a jack of all trades and master of none. So, for instance, when I was a child, you know, my mom would give me secondhand things. I'd have a bicycle, and if it would break, there was no one to tell me how to fix it. I just had to figure out how to fix it. And that pretty much drove me on and on. I got into the mechanical field. I learned how to work on aircraft. I now work in the locomotive industry. And I've always had an interest in the physics of how all that operates. I read all the time. I read about history, art. I like to learn about people. So I think that the definition, all I'm really saying is the definition of a Renaissance man is pretty broad. And I think if, you know, someone takes interest in multiple things, maybe not becoming an expert on any one given thing, that that sort of gives them that title.
Thanks, James. Stephanie mm-hmm. Story, I'm wondering from your point of view, if there is, how you define mastery? Because his contrast of jack of all trades with master of none, do you think that maybe this is partly in how we define mastery?
Yeah, it might be. You know, I was thinking about Charles Nicol, who is one of the most famous biographers of Leonardo da Vinci, called him the most curious mind in history, or the most curious man in the world. And I think, and that reminded me of James talking about being so curious about so many different areas. Now, I don't know whether or not in order to meet some random definition of Renaissance man, whether or not you need to be a master in one of those areas. Leonardo was certainly a master painter, and he was certainly a master designer, and he was also a master party thrower, master of ceremonies. But whether or not you can also stake claim to that Renaissance man thought by just being curious about all of those different areas that he was. I love that idea. And I think Leonardo would have loved that idea of just learning to fix a bike on your own.
There is this self-taught thing. I mean, you were talking about Leonardo having to teach himself many skills mm-hmm. because he was denied access to certain kinds of education.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think he's one of the most famous autodidacts in the world. He really taught, and he said, don't read about it from somebody else. Go out and go do it for yourself. You know, when Bibi was talking about the power of observation between neurology and botany and biology, that's the same that thing that Leonardo had. He wanted to go out and see the thing for himself. Once he saw it for himself and learned it for himself, he knew he would know it. Yes, he built on the knowledge of other men, but he never stopped there. He would have been the guy going out to fix his bike on his own.
Let's hear from Mark Wilson. He's our other Renaissance person. He's retired now, but he used to be a curator of Asian art, then eventually director of the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art, all the while on the side driving race cars professionally. Mark Wilson, hello.
Hi, Gina. How are you?
Good. Do you think of yourself as a Renaissance man?
No, not at all.
Why not?
I don't think that's possible. I do have some thoughts, and I throw these out just as hypotheses. I think if you look at the Renaissance, people we call Renaissance men, and if you look at that period from, I'm going to say roughly 1470 to 1670, when so much of what we think of as advances happened, all of those people who you could lump in there, all their different discoveries, be it Galileo, right up through Sir Isaac Newton, had something in common. One is that curiosity, but the curiosity was universal. And they were extraordinary observers. They observed and observed and observed. And that's what Leonardo's sketchbooks, or the margins, which are just filled of disparate things, machines, plants, tell you about their mentality. And you have also, and from my perspective, one of the most important things about observation is, of course, it leads to categorization, and it leads to this notion, I need to understand how, why. Why are things the way they are? So with Leonardo, yes, this extraordinary study of anatomy through not vivisection, they were all dead, but quite amazing. But look at any of those people, and if you think about what is the root of Western, and I'm talking about of Western material, scientific, industrial, and technical progress, comes down to systematic, obsessive, I think that is a good word, analysis and curiosity, analysis, application, learning, and with the final test being empiricism. And we still today, it isn't true.
Can you define empiricism?
That I can observe something actually happening. And most of what we think of today are tools that simply extend our human senses. All that's going on with these wonderful space shots, these exploratory space shots, are simply extending our human senses.
For observation.
For observation. And whether it's beyond what our human senses can do, we don't see ultraviolet light, for example, or infrared, or these various things. These are an extension of that.
You said you don't think it's possible to be a Renaissance man. Why not?
Here's my definition. Part of my definition of Renaissance man was to know at an advanced level everything that could be known at the time from your perspective. That is to say, from the perspective of Europe. If you went to the perspective of China and its capital in Beijing or at the time of Leonardo, you would have a different perspective on what was knowable in your world. And these people, like Leonardo, like Michelangelo, like many others, knew pretty much everything that was knowable to them and they were at the edges. They weren't necessarily advancing each and every discipline, but they were the edges of mastery. They knew all there was to know about the field without necessarily intentionally trying to advance the field. And in many cases, they did.
So there's just too much to know now.
We haven't. The last person who probably in the Western world and from the Western perspective knew everything that there was to be known was Sir John Soane. And that was almost 200 years ago. And it's simply too old to be. The other feature, I think, of the Renaissance people during the Renaissance was not only were they incredible observers, but the various fields, and there were very fewer fields of knowledge. I mean, after all, science was called natural history. They were able to integrate all of those fields of knowledge in a way that leveraged those fields in a synergistic way so that one fed the other.
But it sounds also like Leonardo da Vinci was such an innovator, so he wasn't merely knowing.
He was an innovator. He was an investigator. Some of his designs are not particularly innovative, actually. you look at the mechanical designs, they are not necessarily innovative. Those are some of those ideas have been around since Egypt. How do you think they built the pyramids, for heaven's sakes? But others definitely were. And he was always experimenting, like any good engineer, with a better way of doing it.
Well, let's just, for the sake of indulging me, let's try to use you as a case study of what it might mean to be a Renaissance man.
This is a hopeless task, Gina.
But you started your career studying Asian art, and then you made a transition from working with the art itself to directing a museum, which
I actually started out as a physicist.
So, okay, working well against my case, from physicist to curator, tell me about that transition.
I, too, was curious about the world, and I think this other factor, obsessive. I will take something that interests me and learn everything there is to know about it, up to the point where I feel I know about it, and then I'll drop it. You can say, did you get bored? Well, no, I still think it's interesting. But do you want to invest more time in learning more? No. But it's obsessive interest, analytical curiosity, not just, and this is thing of jack of all trades. There is about the Renaissance person, the analytical ability, systematic analysis, attempting to make sense. And I will do that in particular areas. But it's no longer possible to do this. And I like our author's story. The last time that we had a jolt, such as we're now experiencing from the internet, was when the printing press came out. And a Gutenberg printing press, I don't mean the Chinese one.
But Mark, I want to get you back to your own experience. So you went from physics to
art. I went from artist to physics with mechanics. All the way along the line. I took my first lawnmower engine apart at the age of 5.
And then you...
And my father's car apart at the age of 14. I almost got it back together.
And becoming a director of a museum, that actually requires you to be a business person, an institutional visionary.
That is correct. But all of my background and interest in different things actually came together to give me that wide variety of skills and the understanding of the different components, including organization.
We've got to take one more break. I'm Gina Kaufman, and KCUR's Central Standard will be right back. Your thoughts on the possibility of being a Renaissance man or woman in today's world when we return. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, here with author Stephanie Story and modern-day Renaissance people who don't necessarily claim that title, Bibi Cronwall and Mark Wilson. Bibi's a neuroscientist and master gardener. Mark is the former director of the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. He was also a race car driver. And Mark, very quickly, how did the race car enter into it? And then we'll turn to our callers.
It's actually taking up racing. It was an extension of the idea of making things better at a leading edge. And always with a car, you can go faster, do something, another tweaking. So how do you make yourself better in order to make something else better? And it's part of that exercise. For me, it was. And what can you do? Always pushing the edge, going a little faster each time once you've broken the sound barrier, making it a little bit better. But it's also, for me, something enjoyable, which is, again, you have to be analytical, you have to observe, and you have to organize and apply what you know.
Let's turn to Chris in Kansas City. Hi, Chris.
Hi. It's interesting. If you know, almost all your speakers have a real common thread. They go between the theoretical, ideological, and the physical nature of things. Ever since I was a kid, I've been called a Renaissance person. I tend to look at myself as a polymath. That's where I take on a field and learn as much about it as I can and then integrate it into my worldview. And I think to truly be a Renaissance person, you have to have just a few main factors: a passion for what you're doing, an intense interest or curiosity. There's a variety to what you do, and you see the interconnectedness between all of these things. And you look at the world in a completely different way than people who compartmentalize it.
You think of it as a disposition, maybe.
It is, absolutely. It's a state of mind. It's a state of being. And as you take these different fields in, they become literally part of who you are. So you're in this constant, almost flow state, and while you're not necessarily multitasking, you can flow from one thing to the next because there is an interconnectedness between them.
Yeah, what are some of the things you've flowed between?
Cosmology, quantum mechanics, medicine, rebuilding cars, construction, you name it. And there is a common theme between all those things. It's understanding their structure, how they function, how they're interrelated, and how they bring a sense of empowerment to you by taking all that in, integrating it into yourself. It said that you need 10,000 hours to be an expert or very adept at something. That's not really that much time when you do that over a lifetime. You can do many different areas and become very adept.
I want to jump in because there is something that keeps coming up, and that is cars. Stephanie Story, are you surprised by this? I mean, Stephen Morris, Bebe's husband, built cars. Mark Wilson, race car driver. Chris, who we just talked to, he talked about cars. What is going on with cars?
And Leonardo designed cars in his notebooks centuries before they were created, and tanks. Maybe it's that idea of movement. Maybe it's that idea of Mark was talking about pushing an edge. I think that's what does it for me with the Renaissance man, is always pushing an edge. And I think maybe moving and speed in the time of the Renaissance, that was seemed an impossibility. And today it's pushing that edge of speed. Maybe that's where it comes from.
Let's talk to Dan in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Dan.
Hi, how are you?
Great. How about you?
Good, thank you. It's a great conversation you're having. There's so many things that you guys are talking about that I myself have been considered Renaissance in certain aspects of my life, but I really wanted to bring up a guy everybody knows, Elon Musk.
In case someone does not know him.
Well, the founder of Tesla, he also invented PayPal. His Tesla company is now making storage batteries that can store solar collected electricity. He's SpaceX founder as well. So in the same way that the word synergistic is being used a lot during the conversation, he has this overall umbrella of thought of making things better on a very grand scale. So I feel that he's kind of a great example of, you know, somebody who this is just an assumption. I'm assuming he gets bored very quickly and moves on to the next thing because he just can't wait to disrupt the next technology and move it forward. So that's why I elect him. And then one other thing I wanted to say about the cars. I think that it's just the idea of making our ability to move more, just faster, to make ourselves more mobile, I guess, in a more energy efficient way.
Thanks, Dan. You know, Dan used a word, disrupt, that I think is interesting in this context. I wonder if being the kind of person we're talking about maybe has always required going against the grain. We're talking about whether today's world is a world that is conducive to being a Renaissance man or woman, but has the world ever been conducive to that? Or is it that somebody who challenges things, who maybe is a social or professional outlier? Mark, what do you think? I mean, do you consider...
I think it's part of the environment that fosters it, the environment of the Renaissance. And the ability, certainly anyone we've been talking about, or the patterns of thought and behavior we've been talking about, go beyond convention. You break, virtually by definition, you go beyond convention. How much of a disruption? I think most advances are more gradual and not disruptive in a cataclysmic way. The internet, on the other hand, is very disruptive. I don't think it's even begun. We're just in the baby steps and we don't know how to deal with it or even ask all the questions. So I think, yes, you do, but what is knowledge that nobody else sees? A person sees a pattern that's always been there, but that nobody else recognized as meaningful.
BB, what do you think? Do you think of yourself and your late husband as iconoclasts of some kind?
Well, I'll speak for myself. So much of science and research is to discover actually the patterns, and see something that has been there all the time, but nobody has paid attention because that wasn't what you thought of at the time. As a graduate student, I was describing certain neurons in the developing brain, and I took notes. I went to my professor and said, this is how it is, and this is what I see. And he said, really? Yeah. I said, come see for yourself. And he did. And he said, yeah, that's true. Let's do this over again and see if we get the same. And it went on and on like that. And yeah. So finally, I got to present this at a conference. And there sat in the audience the man who had used this technique first of all, and described a very nice theory for the development of a part of the brain. And I was very afraid because here I came up with something that really didn't fit. And he was very gracious and said, that is most interesting. It was there all the time, and I just didn't notice or pay attention, because his theory is perfectly all right, but this added a twist to it that with my innocent eyes, I just, without understanding, happened to see.
You bring up innocent eyes, and someone else mentioned the idea of, you know, coming in to a field with a question or with a curiosity, which is very different from coming to it with expertise. And as someone who is coming from an education background as well, I wonder what you think about the way our education system and professional training does or doesn't kind of allow people to come at things with those innocent eyes, as you're saying.
That is a... Do we have another hour? and some more experts on where education is going right now. I really cannot do that. But I can just continue to talk about breaking the mold and seeing a pattern. It happens very often that researchers describe something that breaks all the rules that were in existence. And it can take forever before other researchers become convinced that, yeah, this is actually part of it. And then with time, it pops up that what we thought were the reason for ulcer actually may have some of the old components in it.
Stephanie Story, are Renaissance people rebels?
I think you have to be. I mean, Leonardo and Michelangelo, both of the characters in my book, one of the things I was trying to explore in Oil and Marble was their outsiderness and their struggle with trying to find their place and trying to create their art and trying to make a statement that was outside of the norm. So I think you have to be disruptive in order to be a Renaissance man or woman.
Stephanie Story, thanks for joining us.
Thank you,
Stephanie,
for having me.
Stephanie's novel, based on real tensions between Leonardo da Vinci and Michelangelo, is called Oil and Marble. I'd also like to thank B.B. Cronwall and Mark Wilson for being part of this conversation. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Leonardo da Vinci exhibit at Union Station is up through May 1st. To listen back to this encore presentation or any favorite shows you've heard on Central Standard, just go to kcur.org/Central Standard. Sign up for our podcast while you're there and stay current on our news by following us on Twitter. We are at @KCURCST. Have you ever been walking down the street or driving or riding your bike and noticed something that makes you think, what is that? So have we. That's why we created the What Is That series, where you write us an email about the mysterious landmarks in your neighborhood, and we do some reporting to bring you the story. email centralstandard@kcur.org if there's something you want us to look into. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. Our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs right here in Kansas City. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned to KCUR.